the analogy that I've drawn with working in the White House is it's an awful lot like being an offensive coordinator for, say, a football team, where you are in a climate-controlled booth very far away from where the action is occurring. And, you know, all you can really do is call the play, right? All you can do is send down to the field, like, okay, this is what we should be doing.
I'm Dan Diamond. This is Pulse Check, and that was Paul Winfrey, the guest on this week's episode. Paul spent a year as one of the Trump administration's key policy leaders. He was deputy assistant to the president for domestic policy, the deputy director of the Domestic Policy Council, and the director of budget policy. Now he's back at the Heritage Foundation, and we caught up in his office on Wednesday to talk about his view into Washington's budget and policy battles and what he learned from working in this White House. If the recording sounds a little rougher than usual, we had to switch to a backup audio system this week. Blame the snowstorm hitting Washington, but we still wanted to bring you this conversation. And speaking of conversations, we have some great ones scheduled on the calendar. Everything from more windows into how Washington works to the policy battles that will shape the year ahead. And you can find me at ddiamond@politico.com if you have suggestions on who you'd like to hear from. And now, here's Paul Winfrey. You chose to go into the Trump administration last year at a time when many Republican wonks didn't. Lonnie Chen, Doug Holtzeken, they were on this podcast and basically said in late 2016, 2017, at the beginning, they weren't going to go work for this White House. Why did you say yes when others were saying no?
A few different reasons. One, I have come to policy because I like policy. I have tried to stay in the policy lane and avoid the political lane by and large. And I've worked for, you know, members of Congress before who I, you know, I didn't agree with everything that those members of Congress stood for.
Which members?
Both Jeff Sessions and Mike Enzi. At the same time, you know, they're both good people. And I in the areas in which I worked in, I thought that they were doing good things. And at the end of the day, I mean, I could get up in the morning and go and feel like I was making a difference when I was working in the Senate. And I joined the administration by and large because I kept my nose clean from politics during the primaries. I said nothing publicly positive or negative about anybody and tried to keep the focus on policy and what the next administration should be, you know, should be doing in that regard. I mean, I jokingly told, you know, my assistant in the White House that, you know, if Hillary Clinton had won the presidency and had wanted me to come into the administration, I probably would have joined as long as I saw the ability to make a difference once I was there. And so it was bigger than any single person. And I mean, I've been pretty open. I was pretty open both before going into the administration and then once leaving the administration. I would try to remain as quiet as possible once when I was in there and focused on my day job. But at the end of the day, I think that, you know, any single job within the administration is bigger than, you know, any single individual. And at the end of the day, that includes the president.
You may have tried to stay focused on policy, but it is a politically charged time. Mm-hmm. There is some percentage of listeners who will hear what you say and determine you're a Trump administration ex-staffer.
Yeah.
Paul can't be trusted. Yeah. How do you reconcile that?
I mean, I can't control what I can't control. So if people think that, you know, I can't be trusted because I was in the Trump White House, then, you know, first of all, you know, like I said, I can't control that. The other side of that is that, you know, anybody who's familiar both with my research, and with my public statements, both in the media and in social media, you know, they would know that I'm not just critical of certain things that this administration is doing. I was pretty critical of things that the last administration had done, and I'm fairly critical of both sides, both Democrats and Republicans in Congress. And again, I mean, that comes down to my philosophy that, you know, one of my main jobs and one of my strengths is to try to call balls and strikes in the policy world as I see them. And at the same time, acknowledge that, you know, there are going to be other people who are, you know, very much engaged in the policy conversation with me who are not going to agree in totality with, you know, my perspective on things. But again, my role both here and one of my strengths is to, you know, engage in dialogue with them and, you know, try to see how to advance the ball.
Thinking about how you called balls and strikes in your job at the White House,
yeah,
especially in the middle of the repeal and replace debate, mm-hmm, last year, mm-hmm, can you walk listeners through how you saw your job?
Yeah.
Evaluating different proposals, engaging with the different stakeholders around the department.
Yeah. Yeah. So I always felt like my primary responsibility was to give the president the best counsel that I could possibly give him, both on repeal and replace, also on questions regarding the budget, and larger questions regarding fiscal policy. And there were often times where, you know, I would provide that counsel and you know, the counsel would go nowhere. But that's not uncommon, you know, it's not uncommon of this administration. And it's not uncommon of policy advisors, within this administration. Yeah.
This president famously not a details guy.
Yeah.
How did that complicate your ability to deliver a message to him?
So let me come back and tell a story about Obamacare, and the Obamacare repeal and replace, because I think that it gets to the question that you just asked. I mean, if you think about it like this, you know, the president was pretty clear during the transition in that he on two points. One, that he wanted a bill that both repealed and replaced Obamacare. And that partially came from advice that he had gotten internally from his eventual Secretary of HHS, but also from some internal advisors around him, like Andrew Bremberg, who is very much involved with the transition and is now the Director of the Domestic Policy Council, and then also from Congress, for instance, Senator Paul. The other point in which the president was fairly clear was that Price was going to have the plan, and once Price was confirmed, he was going to deliver the plan.
There was that whole phase one, phase two, phase three.
Yeah,
regulations were going to get overturned. The bill was going to get passed.
Yeah, the whole phases. But at the end of the day, before Price was confirmed, we had no idea what that meant. Price was worried about, you know, Price was, you know, his main job at the time was getting confirmed. And we did not have many interactions with him through that process, just to, you know, keep everybody's nose clean. And so what we were doing in the White House and in the administration writ large at the time was working on a bunch of different proposals that we could essentially lay out to all the stakeholders and say, okay, what direction do you want to head? So at the time, this was at the end of the transition, and then for the first probably 30 days, 45 days of the administration, I was working on a proposal with the NEC's Brian Blaze that was in a very different direction from what we headed, that was focused on HSAs.
Yeah.
Also, it had a component that looks an awful lot like where, you know, where Graham Cassidy is going right now. But at the end of the day, you know, we decided not to pursue that direction.
You're hitting on something that I think we forget now, but one, at the end of 2016, leading up to the election, mm-hmm, it did seem like Hillary Clinton was going to be the next president. That, yep, was widely expected. And two, the folks who ended up populating the Trump administration, especially early, it was, yep, such a potpourri, yep, of different people who never have worked before, yeah, together before at all. And you compare that to the beginning of the Obama administration, yeah, where there was a smoother glide path. Yeah. Obama, at least on healthcare, Obama and Tom Daschle, yeah, had a lot of overlap. Daschle didn't get the job as HHS secretary, but, yeah, a lot of his staff stayed on. And kind of leading up to that election, there was a sense on both sides that there was going to be some healthcare coverage expansion,
yeah,
whether McCain or Obama won. So it was a little bit easier, I think, to plug and play in early 2009 and maybe in early 2017.
Yeah.
Or take that apart if you disagree, but that feels like looking back.
Yeah. I mean, so, you know, going back to 2009, yeah, I mean, there was definitely a focus through, I mean, that started back in 2007, right? 2007, 2008, you know, with Orszag, who ended up at, you know, as Obama's first OMB director,
the
over
CBO
at CBO.
Chief, yeah. We've been very activist on health coverage.
Exactly. And at the end of the day, I mean, you know, just beefing up CBO staff to do more work in that space. You know, but remember, I mean, there was a division within both the administration and the Democratic conference and Congress on whether or not to pursue healthcare or whether or not to go in the energy direction. And at the end of the day, you know, I think Reid and Pelosi and others convinced the president to you know, go in the direction of healthcare first and then to, you know, revisit the energy space a little bit later. You know, the other thing that's going on here, and I think that this is a bit uncovered, is, well, there are essentially two things going on. The first thing going on is, if you look at the Trump campaign was not particularly large. I mean, I think
that's generous. It was bare bones, especially on the policy side.
On the policy side. So you had, you know, probably 100 staffers, and they were off, you know, doing their thing. And then you had the transition operation, and a couple things were going on in the transition. The first thing that's going on in the transition is that we have a new transition process that has never existed, has never existed before the most recent transition, right? So the transition after the 2012 law formalizing presidential transitions literally formalizes presidential transitions, right? So there's, you know, government money involved, there are strings attached to that money, and there are real firewalls in place between the transition and the campaign that didn't exist in the past.
And hadn't been tested.
And so if you looked at the transition operation, which for most of the transition was run by
Chris Christie,
the Chris Christie folks, the makeup of the folks who were on the transition was a bit different than the makeup of the folks who were on the campaign.
So you arrive in the White House, mm-hmm. January 2017. You're moving quickly on repeal,
yeah.
And then replace of ACA. When did you start to suspect that it might not happen last year?
That is a tough question to answer. One, because I like to say that I'm a realistic person, but some may say that I'm pessimistic about policy. But at the end of the day, you know, look, there are two ways in which to influence policy from the White House. The one way to do that is to just drive policy yourself. And I was advocating from very early on, before Price was in place, that's what we should do.
And that's like the plan that you and Brian Blaze came up with,
right?
For instance.
But at the end of the day, you know, if the administration had chosen to go in a different direction, but still had chosen to lead, you know, that's their prerogative, right? So we were working internally on basically two different proposals. We were working on a tax credit proposal, and then we were working on an HSA, like I said, more Graham Cassidy proposal. And what happened was that, you know, once Price came in, his comment to us was, you know, look, I don't want to head in either of those directions. What we should do here is essentially support the House and support Ryan and whatever he can get through the House. And so that kind of changes the strategy, right? That changes the strategy from leading to and doing everything that requires, including going up and whipping your bill on the Hill, to providing support to the administration in whatever way you can. And in a lot of ways, that was extremely complicated. And I can get into that a little bit more if you want.
Well, I want to put a finer point on this. So what you're saying is that the HHS secretary got to call the ball here.
He did, yeah.
And that's something that Tommy Thompson, former mm-hmm. HHS secretary for George W. Bush, mm-hmm. said on this podcast just a week ago. Mm-hmm. As HHS secretary, he felt like he had a lot of independence and authority.
He did.
And the White House checked in with him. Is that a similar relationship to what you had with Tom Price and then, I guess, later Azar?
I mean, look, I mean, the, like I said, I mean, the president was very clear during the transition early in the administration. Tom Price is going to have the plan. And so when Tom Price came in after he was confirmed and said, my plan is Paul Ryan's plan, that was the plan, that was the direction that we were heading in, and we became less of a, you know, leader in the effort and more of a supporter in the effort that the House was moving.
Less of a driver and more of a passenger.
That's right.
So that's the one way that the White House can shape things. Mm-hmm. In retrospect, was that the wrong way to go?
I think so. For a couple of different reasons. One, I think that you're right after inauguration, the president is in a stronger political place than they will ever be in for their entire tenure. And so if there's ever a point in time where you have the ability to lead on an initiative, that's the time. And this administration chose not to go down that path. They chose to kick it to Paul and allow him to see what he could get done and, again, play that supporting role. The second reason why I don't think that it was particularly a good move was in our shift to more of a supporting role, we ended up playing this... basically engaging in shuttle diplomacy, right? Where everybody was coming over to the White House because they felt like they didn't have the ability to, you know, go talk to their colleagues, and they were expressing their concerns of the bill and of the process with us. And, you know, at the end of the day, you know, more often than not, the president would say, yeah, I mean, share your same concerns, and B, you know, what can I do to help you? And that's not helping leadership get their bill across the finish line. The way the members responded to that is they would go back to the Hill and they would say, we just had a meeting with the president, and it turns out the president agrees with me. And they were all saying that, right? And so what ended up happening was, again, everybody was coming to us and saying, you know, here are our issues with the bill. In a lot of ways, all of their issues with the bill and with the process were totally sound. And once the bill was pulled, you know, the big breakthrough happened when the RSC put together this late night meeting with the White House, with the committee chairman, with some folks from leadership in the room, but not the Speaker's office, and with the
different factions,
and in particular the Tuesday group and the Freedom Caucus, to you know, just sit down in the same room and actually talk to each other. And what became very clear to us at that meeting and over the next couple weeks was that was the first time that they were talking to each other about, you know, maybe anything.
And just to put some dates on it, we're talking, that must be what, April 2017? The bill had already failed in late March in the House of 2017?
Yeah, the bill was pulled on March 25th, so literally a year ago this week. And it was the very next week that meeting occurred.
And that's the first time that some of these coalitions are actually talking to each other despite all of the ramp up. Mm-hmm. Does that serve as an indictment of how fast the process was moving? If it had moved slower, could they have hashed these things out?
Definitely. But at the same time, I mean, you know, when the process is all being driven at the top and it's not open, it doesn't seem to me that the speed at which the process moves is really the determining factor. It seems to me that what needs to actually happen is members have to actually talk to other members about what their actual concerns are and figure out some resolution on their own.
Do you think members were being honest? Many of them had said they would repeal the ACA at first opportunity, and then the opportunity came and some didn't.
I do think that most members were being honest. I also think that there are lots of different politics at play. And one of the things that Republican leadership and at the end of the day, probably the White House as well, discounted early on in the process was how reluctant a large number of Republicans would be at rolling back some of the insurance market regulations. We didn't see that before, you know, push came to shove.
This also gets back to the question of the president and his ability to articulate a plan.
Yep.
Barack Obama, whatever criticism someone might have, understood his policy and was able to get into the weeds of what does insurance coverage mean. That's not Donald Trump. Would that have been a differentiator if Trump could have done that, if he could have articulated his plan and really gotten into the policy detail?
Yeah, I mean, that's a different president and a different strategy. You know, at the end of the day, you know, the president did not choose to go down that road. The president chose to go down the road of supporting the House. And once you do that, once you engage in that process, you know, you have to double down on support rather than, you know, basically playing, like I said, playing shuttle diplomacy. We learned from this before the tax debate happened, right? And I think that a lot of the successes of tax reform go back to a lot of these lessons learned. So if you think about the way the tax worked, when members, you know, would complain about, you know, both the process and the policies that they saw, you know, unfolding on tax reform, the White House's response to that would be, okay, that's fine. Go talk to Kevin Brady. Go talk to Paul Ryan, and we'll engage with y'all at the end of the process. And, you know, again, that's the other way to influence where this is going from the White House. You know, Congress builds the bills, right? Congress does the horse trading. What the administration can do is, you know, they can put out a target to shoot at, and they can try to influence, you know, where that's going. But, you know, they don't vote, you know, the president doesn't vote for the bill. The president isn't, you know, in the weeds of the bill as that process is folding. At the end of the day, the president just has one decision to make. Is he going to sign the bill or is he not going to sign the bill? And yeah.
If the president was able to vote for the bill, that would have changed the legislative strategy completely. We might have seen an ACA repeal.
Right.
One last question on the legislative process. Yeah. There has been so much controversy and criticism of the Democrats' strategy with the ACA, and that it was passed in a partisan way, that it was passed too quickly. All of those criticisms could be taken and applied to Republican strategy last year. Does this change in retrospect how you think about the Democrats and the ACA?
I mean, I think, again, this all comes back to the culture of Congress. And, you know, when you have, you know, when party politics becomes a team sport and, you know, you have to, you know, sign up with your team and whatever that means, and when leadership and the leaders of your team are, you know, the ones both drafting the bill and, you know, and whipping the bill and owning the bill, you know, that has, you know, certain, you know, ramifications for both policy and the direction of where everything is going. So I don't think that, you know, there was obviously a lot of criticism of Democrats in 2009, but that by and large reflects where Congress is going and less so where, you know, where one particular party is going.
You've been a critic of measures to prop up the ACA. You did some of the work around the, quote, bailout attack that Republicans used against some of the ACA stabilization efforts.
Yeah.
Do you stand by that?
Do I stand by
criticism that the efforts to help the insurance companies would amount to a bailout?
I think that there are two ways to look at this, and actually there are two competing parties, both within the administration and within, I think, the Republican conference, on how to deal with the ACA. The first party puts a pretty significant emphasis on the exchange markets, right? So the exchanges. They believe that now that Republicans are in control of Congress and Republicans have the White House, anything that goes wrong in the exchanges are owned by Republicans, and voters will show up in a certain way in elections to make their voice heard if that's the case. The other party, and this is where I fall, thinks that the exchanges are important, but also thinks that the wider marketplace is important too. I mean, the exchanges only have about 7 million people, and there are more things that can be done to reduce premiums and encourage enrollment in sort of the wider private insurance market.
And specifically, there are, 10 million people who buy their health insurance off the exchange market, and those are the folks who aren't insulated from the premium increases. They're not getting subsidized when they're shopping for coverage.
Right. I mean, I think that you're seeing this translate itself into some of the things that the administration is doing on the short-term plans, opening up AHPs. That was not a foregone conclusion last year. I mean, there are two different camps. One camp is that we should worry about the exchanges. The other camp is that we should think more broadly about private insurance.
And of those camps, which camp was bigger at the end of the day?
I mean, I think we saw what camp was bigger, and that is that the folks generally think that we should worry about, you know, the larger private insurance question rather than what's going on in the ACA exchanges.
Right, the ACA patch fell by the wayside. One of the things that the administration did while you were there was elect not to fund the cost-sharing reductions. Now, there was a big legal battle behind the CSRs and whether they were going to be funded, but one of the interesting outcomes has been the CSRs didn't get funded. A lot of plans got cheaper for people, at least in the ACA.
Yep.
Did the Trump administration know that was going to happen?
Yes. Yeah, the Trump...
You're not just saying that with the benefit of hindsight. You knew at the time.
No. We had internal analysis both from HHS and OMB that suggested that that would happen. I mean, that was actually one of I don't know if it was really a concern, but it was definitely one of the major asterisks that Secretary Price, when he was still at HHS, brought up when we were considering whether or not to move in that direction or not. I mean, at the end of the day, and I think that this is present, it was a legal question. And it came down to whether or not we had the authority to obligate resources after that legal evaluation. And that's why the call was made. The call really wasn't made over policy.
One major push recently has been around Medicaid and work requirements. I know there's only so much you can say given your role in the White House, but this has been a major focus, and there have been concerns that people who are covered by Medicaid might be vulnerable if work requirements take effect. How do you see that debate?
Well, this is a big debate that we had internally last year, and it's a big debate that I think expands beyond just Medicaid, right? So there are two ways to think about work requirements historically. The first way to think about work requirements is the way in which they're employed in the SNAP program. This is the food stamp program. So in SNAP, the actual work requirement falls on a very targeted population. So it's able-bodied adults under the age of 50 without children. And there is pretty expansive waiver authority at the state level to do away with that requirement altogether, right? So if the unemployment rate is rising by a certain amount over a certain period of time, then states can apply for a waiver not to enforce the work requirement. After the 2009 stimulus, there was a global waiver in the work requirement for the SNAP program. And right now there are a number of states that either waive the work requirement for SNAP altogether for their entire population or for large areas. For instance, West Virginia just submitted a waiver to the work requirement that would cover something like 80% of the able-bodied adult population without children. So that's one way to think about work requirements. The other way to think about work requirements is the way in which they're employed in the TANF program, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, which replaced AFDC in the 1996 welfare reform bill. And the way that the TANF work requirement is structured is that it covers a larger population, but it also includes more things as a definition for work. So it includes job training and all sorts of other things. And there's this ongoing debate within, I think, the policy space, but that's also reflected in the administration on what path to pursue. And the path that CMS has chosen to pursue with the Medicaid work requirement is, we are open to talking to you about the population, and we're also open to talking to you about what you define as work. And I think that that's pretty much reflected in the guidance that they put out. So, you know, in the so for instance, in the guidance, they said that, you know, if a state wants to include, you know, treatment for opioid addiction as work, then that seems to make sense to us, and we're open to entertaining that. And at the end of the day, from a policy perspective, I think that that makes sense to me, right? Because I would argue that, you know, if the point of a work requirement isn't necessarily to force people to work, but to encourage people to engage in activities that either make them more employable or improve their lives in some ways, then maybe that's something that we should be doing.
So we're back in your Heritage office on this snowy day.
Yep.
By my count, this is your third tour of duty.
Yeah.
At Heritage, you just keep coming back.
I just keep coming back.
What did the White House experience give you that you didn't have before? What skill? What exposure? Because if you're back at Heritage, what did that time away teach you?
Yeah. So the first thing that it taught me is policymaking at a different level, right? So I've been in the think tank world, as you mentioned. I've been at Heritage. This is my third tour of duty at Heritage. I also worked in the Senate under a few different members, all at the Budget Committee, and then now in the White House, in the Domestic Policy Council, and as the President's Director of Budget Policy. And, you know, one of the so there are two things that working in the White House basically provides you with that I don't think that you get anywhere else. One is the perspective from the White House. So working in an administration, actually effectuating policy and not just on the law writing side, is a totally different experience, right? So you start to think about the practicality of laws. You start to think about the practicality of how you actually do policy. And, you know, sitting on the outside and saying what should be done or drafting legislation or advising members just doesn't provide you with that same perspective. The second interesting thing that working in the White House provides you with is, and I'm sure that you would hear this from other folks who have worked in other White Houses, is that, so if you think about it, when you go work in, say, Congress, right? Both the House and the Senate, even though the House could, you know, theoretically turn over every 2 years, Congress is a continuing body, right? So there are people who have been members and people who have been staff for their entire careers, right? So they've been working in either the Senate or the House for 30 plus years, 40 plus years. And they know how to do their job. And they know how things were done, and they have a historical perspective to their role in that process.
And I see where you're going with this. There's not the institutional memory in the White House because of the turnover.
There's not the institutional memory in the White House because of the turnover. That exists in the administration, right? You have career officials who, by and large, I mean, I would say 95% of career staff within the administration see their job as serving the president, whoever the president is. And, you know, they carry over some institutional memory from administration to administration that's critical. That's very, very important. Within the EOP, there's only one unit that applies to, and that is OMB, right? So OMB has some institutional memory. Everywhere else, there's no institutional memory. And every executive is different. Right. There are certain things that are the same, but there are certain things that are very, very different. And, you know, when you come into the White House on day one, you know, the carpet's kind of ripped up, you know, they're still repainting from the last administration. They've handed you a laptop and a phone. Nobody's told you how to work said laptop and phone. You know, you have an ID. But there's no guidebook. No one's there to tell you about how to do your job. All you can do is learn from people who you've talked to in the past, who have had your position, but in very different times, dealing with very different things and dealing with very different personalities. And, you know, so it really is whatever you make out of it. And it's a crash course in policymaking.
And especially this time, because there were fewer W. Bush folks there to start. And then there were these various allies and constituencies that had kind of come together in this unusual Trump coalition.
I mean, the other thing, too, is that, you know, the White House is the analogy that I've drawn with working in the White House is it's an awful lot like being an offensive coordinator for, say, a football team, where you are in a climate-controlled booth very far away from where the action is occurring. And, you know, all you can really do is call the play, right? All you can do is send down to the field, like, okay, this is what we should be doing. But at the end of the day, if an audible needs to be called by Peyton Manning, you know, or, you know, the secretary in that case, then they're going to call it. And you, as the offensive coordinator, have to deal with whatever the repercussions are to that call.
And this is usually the part in the TV telecast where they cut to the coordinators throwing his clipboard on the ground. He's so mad.
Exactly. And so it's just a very different role, like I said, that nobody, you know, you'll talk to lots of people who have been, you know, assistants to the president or deputy assistants to the president or special assistants to the president in different spaces and different administrations, and they'll all probably tell you, you know, that they have all the answers, but nobody really knows what it's going to be like in the moment. And I still have a lot of respect for all the folks who were there, doing their jobs, and I'll have, for the rest of my career, the utmost respect for anybody who goes into any of these jobs for any administration.
You were there for a year. Mm-hmm. Do you miss it?
Not at all. But that's just my personality. I'm not someone to look back and you know, and think about the good old days. I mean, I'm excited about what I'm doing now and the things to come. But I will say that when you leave that kind of environment, there's a bit of a hangover. And that's because while the rest of the world is aging in, you know, the rest of the world time, the White House is aging in a completely different time, right? 24 hours in the White House is an eternity.
And it's like five different news cycles.
And both the response that you have to prepare to whatever's going on again in the real world, and then, you know, the planning for what's to come. So, right, to come back to this offensive coordinator analogy, you're having to respond to whatever play was just run on the field, but you're also thinking about, you know, the long run. You're thinking about what's going to happen in five plays from now, what's going to happen next quarter, and so on and so forth. And, you know, that requires, it requires a lot of foresight and a lot of attention and a lot of energy. And coming off of a role like that, it takes some getting used to.
Well, also, there's the pace in doing the job, and then there's the real world outside of it. And you're alluding to this. I was thinking about this last night. I'm filing stories at 11:30 p.m., but I've also got to get outside and salt our stairs so no one falls down. Yeah. And you just kind of do the basic life stuff. Were you able to do that? Were you able to, like, live as a normal human being while in this crazy heightened environment?
I think that at the end of the day, you know, working in Congress, which is also a heightened environment in a very different way, but also a heightened environment, trained me to understand the benefits of boundaries, and so I went into it with a very open mind. I went into it constantly evaluating, you know, my role and the influence that I was having, and weighing that against the commitments that I was that I had to put on the back burner, in particular my family commitments. I have two small children at home. I have a wife who's very important to me. I have a family that's very close to me. I'm active in my church and have sit on several boards there, and all of that obviously had to, you know, move to the back burner when you're working in the White House environment. And so I had very open eyes. And then the other thing that I did after the first month is insane. Okay. So you're sort of learning, you know, where the phones are, you're figuring out how the job works. But after we transitioned out of that first month, I tried to carve out one day a week where, you know, I didn't go into the office where I engage with my family and my friends. And that really, that helped both keep perspective on the job And it also helped, you know, keep them from wanting, you know, to abandon me when the job got tough last year.
It's a snow day.
Yeah.
You had to negotiate with your wife to drive into the office to do this interview with me.
Yeah.
Do you feel like your negotiating skills improved having been in the White House?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I feel like whenever you're put into an environment like that, you develop skills that allow you to figure out what is important very quickly, and then to be able to trade away what is not important while keeping the eye on the end game. And, you know, like I said, I mean, I that improved for me personally. I think that that's improving for the White House, and I think that that ultimately is reflected in some of the success that they've had on tax reform. But that's critical, you know, that's just a critical life skill. So,
well, thanks to you for making time for the interview. Thanks to her for allowing you to come in.
Thanks, man.
And yeah, glad we could meet in person.
Yeah, it's been fun.
That's it for Pulse Check this week. My thanks to Paul Winfrey for making time, Micaela Rodriguez for handling the audio, and to you, our listeners, for tuning in. There's one big way that you can help us. Keep rating and reviewing this podcast on your favorite apps and share it with your friends and colleagues to help them find the show too. You can find me at ddiamond@politico.com. You can find a new episode of Pulse Check in your podcast player next week.